Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, June 29th, 2002. Today's session is titled Hilarity, the Stewardship of Grace, presented by Michael Pellet. The number is POM2002-03. Let's listen in.
Simply the giving of our money, but the giving of our talents, and even with regard to creation. We talk about the stewardship of creation. But what would stewardship of creation mean if the key sense of stewardship would be that of hilarity? Because most of us who have environmental concerns or ecological concerns probably don't approach it in terms of a characteristic of hilarity. I mean, sometimes environmentalists are, you know, kind of caricatured as purveyors of doom and gloom, and they're dour and sour. But here, if you will, I want to suggest, no, we need to be hilarious about it. So what would that mean? First of all, just to do a little thinking here, I know, and that's always dangerous. When you hear the word stewardship, what do you think of? What might be the kinds of synonyms or the kind of quick word associations? What comes to mind when you say, all right, today we're going to talk about stewardship?
Money.
Money.
Money. Okay. What else? Just
service.
Service.
Yeah. Care.
Care.
Budgeting.
Budgeting. Oh, now we're getting to the nasty stuff.
Land.
Land.
Resources.
Resources.
Sacrifice.
Sacrifice. Time.
Celebration and Thanksgiving.
When you say that, time, you ought to be
a cheerful person among us.
When you say time, you automatically add talent.
Okay.
Talents.
Talents.
Leadership, I think, of two.
Leadership.
Gratitude and blessings.
Gratitude.
Tithing.
Blessings. Tithing.
Dinner.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Dinner.
Dinner.
Stewardship
dinner. Oh, I see. Okay, there we go. That's
feed the body and the spirit.
That's it. We're going to get to food too.
Oh, good.
Anything else? From an environmental or ecological point of view, ecologists, ecofeminists, deep ecologists are often critical of the stewardship paradigm of looking at creation or even of looking at our lives in general, because from their perspective, to look at all of these things, they look at particularly something like budgeting or how one cares, kind of link up care and things like land and other things. When we talk about time, tithing, resources, they say when you think about that more profoundly, the whole notion of stewardship is a sense of control or management. And their criticism of that is to say they will go back to something, a passage, for example, like Genesis chapter 1, where God creates the human beings, male and female. He made them, and then God gives the blessing and tells them what?
Be careful, therefore, to
be fruitful, multiply.
Have dominion.
Have dominion. feed the earth, right? Basically, as created co-creators, many interpret that passage, our responsibility is to control and manage the earth and all its resources. And that our understanding of stewardship then would be, whether we're talking about a stewardship program in the church or anywhere else, our tithing, our time, our talents, our budgeting, our care, our money and resources is all supposed to be that we are good managers for God. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. But the criticism would say, in this sense of control and management, it means that the basic way we view those kinds of gifts and resources, and indeed one another, is in terms of use. And therefore, it's the kind of thing, to use again a little fancy talk about this, in terms of values, the distinction is made in terms of instrumental value and intrinsic value. An instrumental value would mean that something is useful. It's useful because it can be used for a different purpose. This pen has, instrumental. This pen has instrumental value because it's useful for writing on the board to communicate what I want to communicate. Intrinsic value means that something is good in itself. It's good for what it is. And so the criticism of this control or management model is that we always think of it in terms of use, and therefore everything is seen instrumentally. That all of creation is simply there for us to use. It's good for something else. And usually human beings that we are, we think that all of creation is good for us. And so that our use of it can very quickly degenerate into, and now we'll use the nasty side of use, exploitation. And so the severest critics of this model say stewardship is just a nice name for exploitation. Right. And that might be something to think about in terms of how you understand your own sense of stewardship, your own actions and activities. Could they degenerate into this? Or again, much more on a broader basis, is this often what happens with the way we use the resources of creation? The other side about this, again, if we're going to think about things as intrinsic values, as good in them, as something that is good in itself, that indeed sometimes we may use it, but we also recognize that if its primary value is that it is good in itself, rather than looking at things in terms of use or even management, it changes our perspective on things in terms of gift. And so that we do not merely have, if you will, resources, but we think about it much more in terms of gifts. What are all the gifts that we have been given? And so here to say the whole model of stewardship, when we think about it in this way, does not become a sense of control and management. But stewardship basically talks about the way in which we practice generosity. And I would like to suggest, and I think there's some helps again in scriptures to get us to think about that, that when God says to have dominion over and to subdue the earth, or in Genesis chapter 2, where God puts Adam, the man, the earthling, into the garden and says, till it and keep it. God has created us to basically say, as my created co-creators, you are to practice generosity just as I practice generosity in creating to begin with. That the gift, or that the action of creation is basically an action of generosity. So we're thinking about all of stewardship here in terms of generosity. And then to push it one more step here, Paul is going to say, and what is the key attitude of generosity? Here we go. Hilarity. The whole sense of, and we can see that in Genesis 2, when after God creates, each day after creating, God says what?
Good.
And that sense of saying good, Hebrew tov, and at the end, very good, mazel tov, is the sense that God delights in everything that God creates. In other words, God sees the generosity of creation and is, if you will, with the rest of the host of heaven, laughing hilariously, is absolutely tickled pink by that generosity. We are not. Let me read from you, or for you, a passage by G.K. Chesterton, who lived at the beginning of this century, a Roman Catholic Englishman.
The last century,
but he comes into this century too. He writes a little book called Orthodoxy. And quite frankly, I think most of us think that any book entitled Orthodoxy is going to be quite dull and boring. This one is not. Here, this is a book where you cannot judge it by its cover. Because it's hilarious. He has all sorts of wonderfully delightful, funny ways of talking about the truths of Christianity, and particularly the truths of God's grace. Here's one passage where he talks about creation and I think that sense of delight and stewardship and what distinguishes human beings from God in terms of understanding what stewardship might be all about. And he says here now, to put the matter in a popular phrase, it might be true that the sun rises regularly because it never gets tired of rising. Its routine might be due not to a lifelessness, but to a rush of life. The thing I mean can be seen, for instance, in children. When they find some game or joke that they specially enjoy, a child kicks his legs rhythmically through excess, not absence, of life. Because children have abounding vitality, because they are in spirit, fierce and free, therefore they want things repeated and unchanged. They always say, "Do it again," and the grown-up person does it again until he is nearly dead. For grown-up people are not strong enough to exult in monotony. But perhaps God is strong enough to result in monotony. It is possible that God says every morning, "Do it again," to the sun, and every evening, "Do it again," to the moon. It may not be automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike. It may be that God makes every daisy separately, but has never got tired of making them. It may be that God has the eternal appetite of infancy, for we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. That sense of delight, I mean, the jarring notion of saying to exult in monotony. And if any of you have little children or are associated with them, right, as parents, uncles, aunts, whatever, you know that if you play a little game and they love it, they will keep at it forever, and you're going, "Oh, please, please, stop, stop." You've lost your hilarity. And the sense here that Chesterton is getting at is that God's stewardship, God's creativity, is that God never gets tired of doing it again and again and again. It's just so delightful to see the sunrise, or the moon, or those daisies. And that's the sense of stewardship here. Do you delight in stewardship? That you just never get tired of being generous again and again and again. God loves a hilarious giver. Okay, that's one. Any comments or thoughts on that?
I have to leave early. I wanted to share with you, my daughter from Sweden sent this, and it's about our taking control of, and I thought, just for the humor's sake, read it, because it's about the EPA and part of creation.
Go ahead, read it for us.
You read it, because your voice carried away to the night.
All right.
Just part of the hilarity that's fun.
Okay, this is the subject here is God and the EPA. God created heaven and the earth. Quickly, he was faced with a class action suit for failure to file an environmental impact statement. He was granted a temporary permit for the project, but was stymied with the cease and desist order for the earthly part. Appearing at the hearing, God was asked why he began his earthly project in the first place. He replied that he just liked to be creative. Then God said, "Let there be light." And immediately the officials demanded to know how the light would be made. Would there be strip mining? What about thermal pollution? God explained that the light would come from a huge ball of fire. God was granted provisional permission to make light, assuming that no smoke would result from the ball of fire. Then he would obtain a building permit, and to conserve energy, would turn the light off half the time. God agreed and said he would call the light day and the darkness night. Officials replied that they were not interested in semantics. God said, "Let the earth bring forth green herb and bear much seed." The EPA agreed, so long as native seed was used. Then God said, "Let waters bring forth creeping creatures begetting life, and the fowl that may fly over the earth." Officials pointed out this would require approval from the Department of Game, coordinated with the Heavenly Wildlife Federation and the Autobahngelic Society. Everything was okay until God said he wanted to complete the project in 6 days. Officials said it would take at least 200 days to review the application and impact statement. After that, there would be a public hearing. Then there would be a 10 to 12 month approval period before, at this point, God created hell. Thank you. Again, right, a marvelous way of getting at the difference between understanding stewardship in terms of control and management and a sense of generosity and hilarity and delight that goes with it. Any other comments that you have on this section, please, Anne?
I think we have a hard time kind of moving along. I know a friend of ours goes salmon fishing, and I think, you know, we tend to think either one way or the other. And it's so much fun to watch what he does when he has, he's a commercial salmon fisherman, so he brings a lot back. But when he does, cuts up his fish, he makes sure he doesn't waste a thing. He's got recipes he makes for the real fine little pieces that are left over. And then he always puts the bones in the garden. And he uses everything. And I think lots of times it's like we either end. We're going to use it, which gets to be exploitation, or we celebrate it, and we just don't know how to bring those things together, which is what we have to do, I think.
Right. The recognition that and the sense of kind of I think, again, it's a great term. Hilarity is what really brings these things together. Because to laugh and to delight, you are indeed employing things. On the other hand, you recognize that it's there because it's a gift. It's a sense of generosity. It's not, this is something I have earned, this is something I deserve, this is something I need. All of those kinds of things that come into play and truly, what? Take the fun out of it all. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, if you have to deserve it and need it and all, you're usually not thinking much in terms of fun.
The science fiction writers invented a group of people called the Inheritors of God. And they teach that God has given them all things. Therefore, they are free to do anything they want to with it. They have no responsibility. They can use it any way they want to. They are not ecologists, folks. They're very unpleasant people.
Okay, second part of all of this, in terms of stewardship and the sense of generosity. Your second test question. If we now want to say that stewardship is not this, we'll bracket this in this way, but want to say it's this sense of generosity, what's the opposite of generosity?
Stinginess.
Stinginess. Somebody said greed.
Hoarding.
Hoarding.
Self-centeredness.
Self-centeredness.
Collecting.
Collecting.
It's always a false sense of scarcity.
A false sense of scarcity.
Affluenza.
That's it.
Leave it to our physician to note that. By the way, that's it. Thanks, Ken, for saying that. I think that was Ken. Have you seen that that video by John DeGraff, Affluenza? If you have, I think Holden has a copy here in the Resource Center in that. If you have not seen that, that's something in terms of this kind of topic absolutely important to see.
And the book's in the bookstore.
And the book is in the bookstore, that's right. Again, it uses hilarity to make fun of us in terms of that whole striving to be affluent. And really what kind of illness this striving for affluence is all about. So they call it affluenza. It's a great, great video. You can learn a lot from it. Other things that you think might be the opposite of generosity.
Use a Dan Erlander phrase, crabbing.
Crabbing.
Talking about the opposite of delights.
Yeah. Okay. I want to pick up on this generosity, hilarity, all of these things. Usually, of course, these are the first things that come to mind. Stinginess, greed, hoarding, self-centeredness. Look at that. But beneath that, again, I think within the biblical tradition, the opposite of generosity is whining. And from here, we see that within the wilderness tradition, 40 years in the wilderness, and I think again here, with regard to Holden, you can look at that in terms of, has it been 40 years of hilarity, or has it been 40 years of whining? And we know, truthfully, it's been a little of both, as it is in all of our lives. But whining, why would whining be the opposite of hilarity? And here again, to before we answer that ourselves, to let the scriptures give us a clue for this. If you have it and would like to follow along, I want to read the manna story. And again, if you know, Dan Erlander has done some work on this in Manna and Mercy. I want to read the manna story, the version of it in Exodus chapter 16. And they have crossed the waters. They have been delivered by God. They are out of Egypt. And all of those kinds of things they have just finished partying and celebrating. Exodus 15 is the song of Moses, which we really know is the song of Miriam, but Moses gets credit anyway. So that, it's that great celebration of having been delivered. And so what do you do when the party is over? Or you think the party is over? That's chapter 16. Begins, the whole congregation of the Israelites set out from Elam, and Israel came to the wilderness of Zin, which is between Elam and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. The whole congregation of the Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And that word complained, Hebrew, would literally mean whine. Right. They were whining. And one of the chief characteristics, if you would read these accounts in Exodus and also in Numbers, what the Israelites were noted for in their wilderness journey was whining. They were great whiners, much to Moses' and God's dismay. Here's how they whine. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Well, they're whining. You gotta whine. If it says they're
really good.
I'm a good whiner. If you need any whining, just... Then the Lord said to Moses, I am going to rain bread from heaven for you. And each day the people shall go out and gather enough for that day. In that way I will test them, whether they will follow my instruction or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather on other days. So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, in the evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your complaining against the Lord. For what are we that you complain against us? And Moses said, when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and your fill of bread in the morning, because the Lord has heard the complaining that you utter against him, what are we? Your complaining is not against us, but against the Lord. Again, here, that recognition that to not see the generosity, to not recognize the giftedness of everything is, again, basic rebellion against the Creator, the one who practices generosity in such a monotonous manner that the sun rises every day. That sense of whining is complaining is against God. And so they go out, and we know the manna story, and the quail come up. And in the morning, the Israelites see this manna on the ground, verse 15, and they ask, what is it? Manu, with the two Hebrew words, manu, you put them together, you get manna. So, I mean, literally manna means, what is it? And sometimes you might ask yourself that as we have lunch. What is it? No. But remember, it's a gift. That's the exact, right? Don't whine. Okay. Right? They asked, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses will then explain in verse 15, the second half. Moses said, it is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather as much of it as each of you needs, an omer to a person according to the number of persons, all providing for those in their own tents. And if you're wondering what an omer is, it explains that in verse 36. An omer is a tenth of an ephah. If you really, to give you the straight answer on that, at least as best as we can tell, they say an omer is about 6.5 pints. So if you really are interested in all those trivial details about what it is, that's the quantity that's there. So they gathered this. Verse 17, the Israelites did so, some gathering more, some less. And now here's verse 18. This is the key verse. This is the verse with hilarity. But when they measured it with an omer, those who gathered much had nothing over. And those who gathered little had no shortage. They gathered as much as each of them needed. You get the picture there? It's a miraculous measuring device. I think about that at time, you know, if you're going out and you're picking strawberries or blueberries, huckleberries, whatever, and one of these, you know, and you're at one of these places, and when you pick those, well, let's just say strawberries, when you go out and pick those strawberries, what's the first thing you do?
Eat one.
You eat only one? Wow, that's wonderful.
Pick one, eat one.
Okay, that's more honest, isn't it? That's kind of the style, right? But then, of course, most folks since, you know, they might sell them by the container and what, you know, you pick them and you really want to heap that container just as full and as high as you can, because after all, you want to get your money's worth, right? And so you can see these Israelites out here with their omer, you know, gathering it all in and all of that. And then Moses, Aaron, and the other elders, they have the official omer, right? And that's the only one that counts, the official omer. And the great thing is that whether your omer is like overfilled or underfilled, when you dump it into the official omer, it's always just enough.
Just enough.
The whole sense there that, you know, those of you who are a little worried, who might be complaining or whining and, you know, want to heap that omer, heaping omers just become enough. And if for some reason you can't quite just judge right about what your needs are and what you need and say, oh, well, I guess that'll be enough, and you underestimate it, you do not suffer for that. But indeed, in the official omer, it comes out to be just enough. And the thing is, again, I don't know, maybe this just shows warpness on my... I think that's hilarious. Right? To think, no matter how it is you think you have to collect and bring things together, that somehow, under God's generosity, in terms of the way in which God measures these things out, it's always just enough. It's delightful, the sense of stewardship that's there, the hilarity that's there. The rabbis, as they comment on Exodus 16, and particularly this verse, the rabbi, if you read the Mishnah and Talmud and all of those things, it's too bad that Rabbi Marx had to leave. I would have loved to hear his comments on it. But as you can imagine, there is just tons of material on this passage. And again, they get it. They catch the hilarity there, the delight that's in generosity. And one of the comments on the whole manna section in Exodus 16 is that basically Exodus 16 is redoing Genesis 1. But it's the short form and cuts to the quick. Because what it does is say what? One, God provides. Two, have Sabbath. Everything else is just detail. The sense here saying that what has happened, as my good marker, as they put it together, is that in Genesis 1 and 2, when God creates Adam, the earthlings, and again, Adam, let's put Adam and Eve in here together as these earthlings, they are put in the garden to till it and to keep it. But that sense of caring for the garden, we'll call this work, is seen as very positive. That indeed what happens, and the change comes in Genesis 3, the chapter of the fall, because of sin, work degenerates into toil. The way in which Adam is cursed for sin is what? What is the curse that God pronounces upon Adam? Does anyone remember?
Work by the sweat of your brow.
Toil. Toil by the sweat of your brow. In other words, human activity is not going to be fun anymore. Sin takes the hilarity. Blinds us to the generosity of it all. And so when we are created, this sense of work, again, that understanding of stewardship, if you will, was based on generosity and hilarity. Like Adam and Eve had fun in the garden. What fun they had, you can decide. Right? After Genesis 3, the fun is gone. But the rabbis tell us in Exodus 16, the fun is back. The fun is back because this is bread from heaven. This is a new creation, that what happens again in the wilderness is having been freed from slavery, having been delivered from Egypt, God is creating a people, just like God created a people in Genesis 1 and 2. And just like in Genesis 1 and 2, the people did not have to toil because all was gift and all was based upon God's generosity. So now in this new people, in the wilderness, where you would think, well, if anywhere you're going to have to toil, it's in the wilderness. Part of the teaching and learning that God wants to happen in the wilderness, that in creating a people, it's a people again that takes us back to Genesis 1 and 2. It is a new people that again recognize God's liberating generosity, delight in that, and live with each other in the same way. So that the rabbis understand Exodus 16 as basically doing Genesis 1 and 2 over again. And that in many respects, every time we rehearse these stories, every time we engage in this kind of activity of generosity, we are creating the world over and over again as God's co-creators. It's here somewhere, if I can find it. Yes. This is one of the things that Philo of Alexandria says. He's a Hellenistic, a Greek-speaking Jew and Jewish thinker in the first century. And he says here, on commenting on this passage, I think a wonderful summary. The manna was not something that would be stored up and dispensed gradually, since God is accustomed always to give his gifts afresh. God is accustomed always to give his gifts afresh. That's what Israel was to learn by wandering for 40 years in the wilderness. They were to learn that sense of generosity and hilarity. But as we see, that often that didn't quite work out. They became complainers. And it is out of this complaining, it is out of this whining, that now all of these attributes that you've noted here fit in. In other words, when you're whining, if you're complaining, because of that, now stinginess and greed and hoarding and self-centeredness and collecting and a false sense of scarcity, crabbiness, affluenza, all of that comes about. But of course, again, in this hilarious fashion, God shatters all of that with the official Omer. Because God refuses to let you measure, to control, or manage anything according to these attributes. Say, so, yeah, well, yeah, you can stack your little manna basket just as full as you want, but it's not going to work. The old official Omer is going to get you. So, you know, how long is it going to take you to learn enough? And the sense there of stewardship, generosity, is learning that sense of enough. That's the second part I want to talk about. Any comments or more thoughts about that? You want to do some complaining?
That's why the first 2 weeks of summer were called work camp. And not toil camp.
And not toil camp.
There was no greed, there was no crabbiness, there was no whining. Well, those are the diesel tanks.
Not even down in the diesel tanks? No whining?
We whined, but we were just kidding.
Okay.
He whined with laughter.
I was just going to say that in my experience, you know, when I first came to Holden, that sense of work with hilarity was so pervasive at Holden. And I think it has been through the years. There's been whining, and there's been, you know, but really, Holden is a wonderful model of work with hilarity.
Mm-hmm. With this contrast, there's a fear you pull into yourself. You get depressed, you get frightened, you get afraid. You need to be protected, or you feel you need protected. But with God's generosity and grace, fear is gone. And you don't whine.
Oh, I'm glad you think so.
My mother used to say that when you were sad or feeling miserable, to just stop and count your blessings. And if you couldn't find any blessings, then ask someone for help.
Yeah. Any other thoughts? Yes, please, Anne.
Well, what do you do with people who genuinely are suffering?
Who are suffering?
Yeah.
Okay. And behind that question is what? That you think that folks
well,
who
I
that
was
folks
thinking,
who suffer are folks who whine or complain?
No, I'm talking about genuine suffering, and I actually was thinking of the Holocaust, and I was thinking of times when it is so hard to find any blessings, and you could legitimately say, well, and I know, I mean, I think the difference between survival and not survival in those places is finding something, but it is, there are the extremes that make it sometimes. I'm talking about the extremes.
No, I understand. I see what you're asking there. A good question. Any responses? Any thoughts to that? How does one respond with this kind of sense of generosity and hilarity in the face of suffering?
Well, I just thought of when you were talking of that the line in Psalm 23, prepared a table for me in the presence of my enemies, and that somehow there is this. The ones who do survive don't lose the sense of hope or meeting somewhere. So there's still a sense of this complete absence of somehow being blessed. Mm-hmm.
There's the story of the woman who lit the Sabbath candle in the cattle car as they were being carried across Germany. And that's a tremendous act of faith.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then
Karen and then Laura.
Well, there's the tension between theology of glory and theology of the cross, and people that tend to glorify suffering in a trivial way and not recognize it, and so there's a last night you said don't call evil good, don't call good evil. In other words, if someone's suffering, don't run up to them and say, oh, aren't you being wonderful? Are you being hilarious today? Because, so there's a sense of God with you in the suffering. And maybe from that comes the generosity of hope. I mean, it's sort of...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of hard there to do that. Laura?
I just say, some of the stories I've heard on the Holocaust, it was people that did find ways to find that sense of generosity, you know, the hilarity of it, you know, that survived. I mean, Corrie Ten Boom tells the story of you know, that they gave thanks for the bugs in their bed because they began to realize that as they did that, that's why the guards didn't bother them with their Bible study and their rituals in the evenings, because the guards didn't want to be around the bugs. So, I mean, it was kind of a twisted way, almost the similarity that, you know, it was the bed bugs that kept them, gave them what they really needed was in their worship time.
Paul.
And perhaps it's incumbent upon those of us who aren't suffering to take note of those who are. Mm-hmm. That's one of the great things that comes out of that novel, Sophie's Choice. Mm-hmm. That ends with, tell me, at Auschwitz, where was God? And his answer is, where was man? Mm-hmm. Watching you. Women, too. Mm-hmm.
Yes, right. Yeah, I think that these kind of thoughts are critical because, although, I mean, it can help you to realize, you know, how to deal with, or maybe how to deal with a situation like that. By having that sort of attitude, it helps us to deal with smaller situations as they come up, rather than letting them go on, get worse, and so on. I think it's the same feeling inside. It may be easier to deal with, but it can be difficult. And I like being able to look at the ultimate, like the Holocaust, to find ways to deal with grief, mm-hmm. suffering.
And
I guess one of the things that's been helpful for me is I think if you go to parts of the world where suffering is a much more daily experience, but what was really just sort of a light going on is there was no different range of happiness and sadness, human happiness and sadness. And I think it's in our bones somewhere. We are sure that you've got to have certain things in order to be happy. And so that's another part of it. I think that we are so conditioned to think that I don't know where that comes in, the stingy. It's the false sense of scarcity, but it's also a false sense of fear, a fear of being without certain things, and being sure that people that don't have what we think we have to have are don't have the range of human emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that brings to mind a sense of St. Augustine as he comments about the notion of whining, but even under the notion, the understanding of security, or he wants to talk about it in terms of desire, and he understands desire often in a negative sense. That, you know, that because desire, if we always want to, he would say, try to satiate our desires. It's the sense that we never have enough. And the thing is that if your life is centered around or organized by desire, he says it's the worst kind of life you can have. Because, first of all, you're going to spend all your life trying to get what you think you need. But the thing is, once you get it, then you're going to spend the rest of your life worrying that somebody's going to take it from you. Right? That there's never enough, that you can never be secure, you can never be satiated, because you either have to get it or you have to make sure you don't lose it. Right? So, you know, you work hard, you win the lottery, and then, oh, well, they're going to take it all from me in taxes and whatnot. And, oh, you know, you just can't win. And that's true. If you organize your life by desire, you can never win, because there will never be enough. But, again, centered in this sense of recognizing generosity, the giftedness of everything, you know, you delight in what you have. It works that way. I also want to respond to, oh, Very quickly here, Anne's question about suffering and all of that, and for that again, I want to go back to Paul in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9, where we were saying that God loves a cheerful or a hilarious giver. And there too, Paul is responding to, I mean, the reason he's asking the Corinthians to contribute to this collection is to help the saints, the believers in Jerusalem who are suffering from famine and everything else. And so again, for Paul, an understanding of generosity flows out of this. He begins with this, holding up the churches in Macedonia, up in north, if you will, northern Greece, and how they give. And again, he says, the very beginning of chapter 8, we want you to know, brothers and sisters, about the grace of God that has been granted to the churches of Macedonia. For during a severe ordeal of affliction, their abundant joy and their extreme poverty have overflowed in a wealth of generosity on their part. So he uses that here we have people who are in a situation of some kind of persecution or whatnot, of poverty, and yet they practice generosity. That to look at that, Paul's answer is, what about suffering and all? Paul understands suffering as one more opportunity to practice generosity. On the part of those who are suffering, that's where he starts out. But then, as he's talking to the Corinthians, he would say, much more on those who are not suffering. In other words, that understanding that we could look at a situation of suffering, this is not to glorify suffering, don't misunderstand that, but it's the sense of suffering again provides us the opportunity to practice generosity, to be who God created us to be, generous. And in that sense, we can look at that in terms of God is giving us these opportunities daily. Right? Again, it's the generosity that we can practice. In again, the little things. I want to think about Chesterton, that sense of monotony. You know, how boring every day to have to cook or whatever. And yet it's precisely there where the practice of generosity happens. The cup of cold water for the little one, the least. That's the generosity that's there. That's the hilarity that we're talking about. Where does Paul ground it all? My last word, and then we shall quit. And that is 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 9. Where Paul says, for you know the generous act of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich. Right? Here, Paul understands the cross as God's supreme act of generosity. And some of you may have heard me earlier this week talk about, you know, Luther got that. He looked at this passage and he said, what this is all about is the glorious exchange, the freiliches Wechsel in German. And again, if you translate freiliches, it would be truly hilarious. That the sense here is Luther looks upon the cross as God's hilarious exchange. Christ becomes who we are so that we might become who Christ is. That is the supreme act of generosity. That's what grace is all about. And Paul, Luther, God say, you know, that's hilarious. So, thank you. Our time is up.